welcome you to the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast. This podcast is coming out of the Trauma Informed Educators Network Facebook group. I am so looking forward to talking to people globally about their trauma informed journey. As the principal of Fall Hamilton Elementary School, a trauma informed school in Nashville, Tennessee, I have learned that this is not a destination, and it truly is a process of learning and adjusting. So this podcast will be speaking to guests all over the world about people who are just starting their journeys and people have been on this journey for many, many years. So I hope you enjoy our guests. I hope you learn something just as I am. And welcome to the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast.
Oh man, is this going to be an awesome episode? This is episode number 36, and this is actually a reunion of three previous guests who have been on the show: Dr. Mona Delahook, Dr. Eric Rosen, and Dr. Lori Desitels. We are going to dig into everything from the neuroscience all the way down to classroom instruction. So hold on for the ride, get ready, and here is what our special reunion of three previous guests had to say. All right, here we are with our Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast. I called it a reunion, even though you all three weren't on at the same time. It's a reunion for me. So I am so excited to have three of the top experts in this field right now doing this work that is transforming how we see children, how we see each other, and how we see education. So thank you, all three of you, for agreeing to come on and just have a conversation. So I'm going to give each of you a moment to do a quick introduction, tell a little bit about you, and then we're going to jump into the meat of your work and the work of trauma-informed education. So Dr. Lori, we'll start with you.
So, well, first of all, Matthew, thank you so much for creating this event. We wouldn't be together without you. And so I'm just very, very grateful for your passion. And so I come tonight from really just doing some work at Butler University. I'm teaching graduate courses there. And I am back in the classroom. This is my seventh year. So I'm taking this work, this framework of applied educational neuroscience, and two mornings, or a morning and an afternoon a week, I am back in co-teaching in the classroom. So we're integrating the practices that we'll talk about tonight into the classroom. So it's just a really hard time with this pandemic. I think we're crisis teaching right now. It's much more than virtual teaching or hybrid teaching. It's just a really challenging time for our communities, our families, our educators, and our kids.
I can second that. I agree. And our educators are, they're hurting right now. Let's just be honest. Like so many other people in our community, including our kids. And I see it every day. And as a principal, man, it's hard work right now, making sure teachers have the support. Dr. Delahook, tell us a little bit about you before we jump in with Dr. Rosen, and we'll get into this.
I'm so excited to be here. Well, I think I'm the only one of the four of us that's not an educator. I'm a clinical psychologist and mom, and I have been witness to three decades of support for kids with challenging behaviors. That turned out to be one of my subspecialties, along with infant and toddler mental health and neurodiversity, starting about 20 years ago. So once I figured out and integrated neuroscience into my practice, and of course, neuroscience is evolving. I mean, I'm just talking about the decade of the brain of the 90s. But once I started to kind of look at the impact of taking state regulation, physiology, and our nervous system into account, I realized that my field was really in the dark ages with targeting behaviors as the focus of treatment. So labeling behaviors with a DSM diagnosis, targeting them for change, without consideration for the underlying causes. So that became my passion. And I wrote Beyond Behaviors as a call to arms, so to speak, for therapists, teachers, and parents to get together to say we can have a different focus. And that focus becomes more compassionate when it's based on neuroscience. So, in a nutshell.
And you know what? A great nutshell that you put it in. And I think it goes so deep. And I just saw you got your 600th review of your book on Amazon, which is huge. And I think it was even one of the top sellers for a while. It may even be now. And I know I have it. Matter of fact, it might be right behind me. I haven't looked. But both Dr. Lori and Dr. Mona's work is so powerful. And I'm so glad you're here. So Dr. Rosin, tell us about you, man, and what you're up to.
Sure. So again, so happy to be here. Thank you for all your work. I've listened to just about every podcast so far, including Mona's and Lori's, which I love both of them. So I am a school psychologist by training. I got into this work working in a large school district, and like so many others, experienced the dissonance between what I was seeing and what I was learning in ongoing professional development and when I came upon this work, and really having a hard time reconciling when I would learn about what was happening in the child's life and seeing that what we were doing in school was really not an effective approach, and slowly learning all the different factors and variables, the environmental variables, the school variables, the individual variables, the family variables. I realized I had so much to learn. So I really, really dug in, and I'm also a licensed psychologist. So I was doing private practice, and I saw just the total difference in the kinds of family units and the systems within which mental health services are provided. So I've been working at the National Association of School Psychologists now for almost 11 years. A lot of this work I do kind of for fun and on my own, which gives you a glimpse into my robust social life over the last decade. But I've been thinking a lot about things like trauma-informed IEPs. I've really been recently digging into a lot of the work around restorative practices, and the book from Joe Brummer, who is one of your recent guests, I loved. I'm such a novice student now on thinking around equity issues and systemic racism, which I have to admit, and I'm embarrassed to say that, but I've been reading a ton in critical race theory. And as we were talking earlier, you know, before we started the broadcast, everything I do and see and read, I think through this lens now. So it's become a part of how I think through everything. As we were talking earlier, you know, thinking about Harry Potter through a trauma-informed lens and his Hogwarts trauma-informed school. And so anyway, happy to be here.
Well, thank you all for being here. I'm excited to engage the listeners too. And if you're on social media, please ask questions. We'll throw them up onto the screen and allow our guests to answer. What I want to start in is I want to start off on the big picture. I want to talk about the neurodevelopment and the impact of neurodevelopment in schools. I want to talk about the psychology around what is the traditional behaviorist mindset that have so much of our schools established on, and how is that paradigm beginning to shift? And then I want to get all the way down, especially to you, Lori. I see your videos in the classroom about that connectedness and making sure kids have those de-escalation skills. So let's start big. And Dr. Mona, I want to start with you because I know your passion around some of the archaic strategies and structures that we use in education. So let's start with the traditional form of behaviorist thinking that we have in education.
Okay, well, let's go even beyond education then. Let's go to culture. Let's go to how we were likely raised. Let's go to how our world views behaviors, really. And that is that we are accustomed to viewing behaviors as the target instead of viewing behaviors as the signal, as my colleague and friend, Dr. Ross Green says. Behaviors are signals. So now let's go to education and even mental health. How many of us were trained that behaviors are signals of something else? And how many of us were trained that there is a variable, the most important variable, in between a stimulus and a response is a human being, is a nervous system. Mm-hmm. So many of us in our culture and in our education system and even in mental health, the idea that we need to understand the nervous system of the student, the patient, the child, and our own nervous system before anything else is the breaking news. So the answer to your question is such a good one. And I also like to say that this information is not meant to shame or to make people embarrassed or to have any sort of negative impact. We need self-compassion more than any time else in the history of the world, right? We have been under life threat for over a year collectively in our world. So self-compassion here. But with all due respect, over hundreds of observations and many hundreds of IEPs, I have observed over the last several decades that behaviors are not properly contextualized in our education system for the adaptive purposes they serve. And once we can get our minds around that, we will go from thinking about a compliance and non-compliance framework to a neurodevelopmental framework. And that's what my work and Lori's work and Eric's work. And, you know, I think a lot of people, I'm a translational psychologist. I'm not a neuroscientist by far, but I like to translate neuroscience into practical use. And the polyvagal theory was the most user-friendly theory that I latched onto. Fortunately, I learned about it almost 20 years ago. But that theory can guide us as to how to shift our system. This is a rugged system. This is a stubborn, rugged system, man. I adore educators, but please, we have to move away from focusing on behaviors as the target, focusing on behaviors as the valuable signal. Mm-hmm.
So how do we do that? I mean, I ask that. I actually know some of the answers to that question, but if we have listeners, what does that mean? How do we do that? And Dr. Lori, how do you do it? I've seen it in action. I've watched the videos, you know, and I think Dr. Mona's book, you do that. You take that large picture and you bring it down to where it's like, ah, that makes really good sense. So, So to all three of you, this is just a conversation. How do we do that? How do we think about polyvagal into classroom? How do we think about the nervous system and stress responses? How do we?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Mona for that really beautiful overview, because it is, you know, you think of behavioral challenges, these are nervous system challenges. And when you think about where we begin, that's what I love about the neuroscience, because when you share the why beneath the behavior, when we begin to share that with each other, then we have this deeper understanding that, again, like Mona said, the behavior is a signal. So some of the things that we can begin doing in our schools is, right now I'm beginning with the adults, because behavior management is never about kids. You know, it is about the adult nervous system. And so, you know, every single time right now that I'm working with districts, I meet with administrators. And you know, Mona, you said that so beautifully, that, you know, it begins with us. So, you know, looking at, and then I'm smiling because yesterday I was with first grade, second grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, and sixth grade. And we are changing our procedures and routines, not only for the adults, but for kids. So they began, each of these classes had never, ever, they were tough, tough classes. And they had never heard about the brain. They know their labels. Believe me, kids know how they are seen. And that is, you know, that's a challenge too, because we are so traditional in talking about behaviors in schools. So we began yesterday talking about their brain and body states. And I actually showed the sixth graders in honor of Kobe Bryant, because he passed away a year ago and 2 days ago. The middle schoolers, you know, we talk about breath and movement, but they really have buy-in when they see some of the, you know, athletes using breath and talking about mindfulness. So, you know, and the little ones, you know, we have different approaches. So we're moving away from behaviors. We're not talking about that. We're talking to kids about, you know, do you feel like you're, and again, we're being very schematic. I mean, the brain doesn't work like in these specific regions, but for our understanding in the schools and for teaching it to the children, you know, they know when they're functioning from their cortex, they know when they've downshifted into their amygdala, and they understand too when they're in their brainstem. So it's a process. It's a slow process.
And we don't give kids credit enough. I mean, we really don't, because they get it. I want to say it's not brain science, but it actually is brain science. But they get it, right? I mean, when we are open and honest with our kids and explain the function, they get it. And I think that's the power of giving kids this information. I just had a conversation with my 10-year-old who gets it. And I think that's where we have to be having conversations in schools, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I was going to jump in just, you know, following Mona and Lori is always a challenge, of course, because they cover it so well. But, you know, the idea that Mona said, this compliance mindset. And I think in many cases, you know, it's an order of operations problem, because a lot of times there's this view that compliance is a prerequisite for effective education and learning, versus established relationships is a prerequisite for learning. And we need to teach a range of prerequisite skills, like regulatory skills and things like that. The behavior that we seek will come later. But, you know, I think, you know, in thinking about the brain science, we need to realize that in many cases, in learning about stress responses and how they are triggered and the chronic nature of stress responses makes them more likely to be triggered in the future, that many of the behaviors we see are often caused versus a calculated, willful process that's thought through. And that reasoning in the heat of the moment, like questioning a kid, why did you, while tensions are high, asking a 5-year-old, why did you spit on him, is a rhetorical question. And regardless of the answer, it doesn't really matter, right? And so we need to like think about what is the trajectory of that brain response and the stress response. And those like 3 R's from Dr. Bruce Perry, right? As far as like regulating and reasoning and relationships. You know, and I may have mentioned this on my first podcast with you, Matthew, but I talked about the hot-cold empathy gap. I don't remember if I did, but it's this idea that we have, and there's some research behind this, that we have like kind of 2 states of being, right? You have your hot state, which is, you know, when you're fired up by emotions and you're acting on instinct. And then you have your cold one, which is your cold state, which is rational. And there's a lot of research that shows that a lot of times we're in a cold state, and we make assumptions about ourselves, and we're often, we can't empathize with how we act ourselves in a hot state. So I'm going to go to the bar tonight, but I'm only going to have 1 drink. I'm going to not eat cake at that birthday party today, right? I'm not going to act in this way. And then you get home later, like, what happened? I thought I was going to act like this, and I didn't. And it's been shown with like smoking and eating and all sorts of different behavior.
Yeah.
And so with kids, it's the same way. A lot of times we'll have conversations with kids and we have a plan. And then they get in a hot state because their stress response is activated. And right away we're like, what happened? And they say, I don't know. And we say, that's not an acceptable answer.
Yes.
And, you know, it's just another example about how there's a lot of science that we need to, that has a practical application and our ability to use that to be more effective in skill building and responding. We're lagging on, but we're all working on it.
Oh, I just, Eric, I loved that you posed that situation of asking a child, why did you do that? Because this is the other piece that you touched on that most teachers don't know about and most parents don't either. And that is that there are two major kinds of behaviors, top down and bottom up. Bottom up behaviors are instinctual automatic responses. So typically if the child really fast spits on someone else, it's an automatic instinctual behavior based on the neuroception of threat, a body sense of threat. That kid isn't going to have any idea why he spit. He's not going to say, well, actually, my neuroception just ticked off that I was under threat. And my amygdala kind of rattled off that little spittle and I'm not responsible. No. What the child is going to do is that they're going to make up a reason. They're going to make a story up for the reason, because even worse than getting punished is getting shamed, is feeling shameful. And most kids don't want to spit on other people and get in trouble. All kids don't want to get in trouble, right? Kids do well if they can. So here's another good thing for teachers to know, and that is that there are behaviors that are subconsciously driven. You don't want to ask a child about that behavior because it shames them and it makes them feel worse. Nor do you want to throw them in a timeout room or put their red chart, you know, rank them on the behavior chart, because what that does to the nervous system is shame. Increase the distress in the child. So we have it kind of backwards.
Yeah. And you know, and I just had a conversation with my previous guest, James, about this and how we explain it to adults. And we both did the same thing. We said, if we're going to use these behavior-based upfront public shaming modes, then we have to use them with the adults too. And that, when you see the teachers are like, wait, I'm like, no, it's not. I mean, you know, if you're on your cell phone in the faculty meeting, I'm just going to call your name out loud. You're going to get up, you're going to walk up, you're going to clip. Like that, we have to continue to have these conversations of these are just little human beings. And I think too, another piece that resonated with me when you're talking about that response system that isn't voluntary, I always use the analogy is if you are at the funeral of one of your closest loved ones and you are in that emotional state, which is grief, and somebody comes up to you and says, you need to calm down. You can't calm down. That isn't something that your responses are going to be able to, your physiological self isn't going to be able to do. Our kids are in that state, not necessarily grief, some are, on so many levels.
Yeah, and there's,
yes.
I think there's two pieces there, you know. One is the stress response, which is, you know, I think we need to be mindful of, particularly for kids with a history of chronic stress, because we know that the stress response, when repeated activation of a stress response can generate a faster stress response in the future. Right. And so over time, what that looks like is that to an objective observer, you know, your threat level, your level of hypervigilance, or that student's level of hypervigilance is totally inappropriate based on the context. But I'm using my my subjective lens as an educator is fully regulated, and applying that to someone whose stress response has been going on, on a daily and continuous basis. So, you know, I think that's a lot of times we're making a lot of assumptions. And the other piece is when you said calm down, and it made me think about this idea when I remember walking through schools and seeing students that were told to take a break and calm down, right? And so go outside and calm down. They're literally sitting in the hallway. A lot of times I realize that these kids are not able to calm down. And it's because multiple things, but it's also you never actually taught the skills on how to regulate yourself. Or even when there's a break corner, how do you use that space? Are we actually explicitly teaching students how do you use a break space? What are the strategies that actually help you calm down versus just expecting that 3 minutes on your own is actually going to de-escalate you versus actually make you more escalated in stress?
Yes, and even below that, so neurodevelopmentally younger than that, that's a great, that's an excellent point. But even neurodevelopmentally underneath that is the principle that self-regulation is an embodied experience. And little humans and big humans need social engagement to calm down. They need another human. That's how we're built. The neuroscience of love, of the polyvagal theory, is that when a human is in distress, they need co-regulation with another warm body, a human. And so in addition to, like, later on, we build those skills on, hey, what can you do to calm yourself down? But to me, the biggest misunderstanding that we have for traumatized kids is that, and those are the ones who, like Eric said, get put outside to calm down, right? Or get sidelined because their behaviors are so bad. And the system and the teachers and everybody, again, with the best intentions, don't want to reinforce negative behaviors. But it's the opposite. A negative behavior that's uncontrolled and that's chronic, and as Eric said, sensitized. A sensitized stress response is when you're triggered by the tiniest little thing because your nervous system is so overreactive. What you need is another human. And so that's where, you know, where all of us are coming in and saying relationships matter. It's, and that's what you're famous for, Matthew. You tell people relationships matter in this school. I want everyone to feel safe in this school.
And that includes the adults.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that that's where we have to continue with our visions. As if you're a school administrator listening, if you're a school counselor, if you're a teacher, looking at this through, this is as much of supporting adults as it is, and if sometimes, honestly, if not more, then it is the kids. It's that state of safety, right? And Lori, I think you are doing, when teachers say, okay, that sounds great, you know, what does it look like to teach this, right? What are some strategies I can go to right now into my classroom and do? And I think you have invented some amazing, like, turn around tomorrow, get a couple things off of Amazon, and bam, you're teaching some seriously amazing de-escalation strategies. Talk about some of those, because, you know, the what we get, but the how, like, what is it that we actually do?
Yeah. So, I mean, I love this conversation tonight. And one of the things that I'm learning every day, besides looking at these dysregulated nervous systems and understanding what's beneath the behavior, is really looking at discipline that is relational, that is preventative, and that is brain aligned. And that's, we tend in schools and in our homes to be very reactive. And so this is a big shift in this framework that we are rolling out to schools. You know, we're really, first of all, addressing adult, you know, looking at, because every practice that focuses on the nervous system and really understanding that this is not just about the brain, this is about our bodies. And Mona, you said that these are embodied experiences. You know, when we feel that shortness of breath, when we get hot, when our, and you know, when we get that lump in our throat, you know, our bodies are communicating that trauma. So some of the things that we're doing in our classrooms and schools, and this is for administrators, you're, as an administrator, your classroom is your staff. So when the kids come in, we are incorporating as part of the procedures focused attention practices. And these focused attention practices are part of the procedures that include movement and breath. We're using art, we're using pressure, we're using coolness, heat. We're really focusing on body sensation, because this is where, you know, I love that saying, if you want to know which way the sand is blowing, if you want to know which way the wind is blowing, look at the sand. And it's true for children. If you want to know how a child is feeling, look at their body. So, you know, we don't calm down by words when we are in that survival state. We don't hear words. We don't care about consequences, logic, rewards, or stickers. And oftentimes we're disciplining when we are in that dysregulated state. And emotions are contagious. So that's, we're beginning with the adult brain and body, but we're putting in a lot of regulatory practices, increasing vagal tone with movement, you know, looking at the power of storytelling and art. So that's, and the book is filled with resources, you know, that for staff and for students and for parents. I mean, this is as much for parents. I've always said I would have been a different mom to Andrew and Sarah and Reagan when they were little, had I known what I know today.
Well, and I think too that when we talk about mindfulness, right, that is such a term and practice that we hear all the time. This is what we're talking about when we talk about mindfulness, especially with adults, understanding your own systems and stress responses, knowing when you become to be, when you're triggered, knowing that your heart is beating or knowing that your hands are getting tight, or it's such a skill. And I want to reinforce that to the listeners, especially if they're on this journey at the beginning. These are skills that take time to develop. I'm 6 years in, y'all, and I feel like some days that I'm brand new to this work of trauma-informed principling, right? Like, oh my goodness, why did I say that? Why did I respond like that? Like, I should know better. Mm-hmm. But it's hard work.
I think what is, you know, when you talk about the relationships that matter, you know, good relationships actually buffer to some degree against those experiences. And I think, you know, we talk a lot about unconditional positive regard and the importance of unconditional positive regard in how we interact with students. This idea of this no strings attached relationship that I will always be here for you and I, no matter what, even when I'm angry, even when I'm stressed, even when I'm frustrated, and even when I yell, and even when I become dysregulated, that the student knows that. I mean, you know, and that's why zero tolerance policy, among many other reasons, is so bad. It is the ultimate violation of unconditional positive regard, because it says your belongingness here is conditional on how you behave on any particular day.
Eric, no, that's such an important point. That point cannot be yelled loud enough from the mountaintops for teachers and administrators, because they are taught that if you pay attention to a bad behavior, you are going to increase the chances of that behavior occurring in the future. This is what we spend millions upon millions of dollars on behavioral FBAs and behavioral treatment contracts, where the aides and teachers are told that if they don't consistently ignore a certain behavior, or which is the child, that they will be making the child's problem worse. And this idea of unconditional positive regard, which was Carl Rogers in the 1950s, I believe, a psychologist, has gotten lost. It got buried by behaviorism. And don't get me wrong, behaviorism was interesting stuff, right? In the 40s and 50s, the stuff that the at Harvard, you know, our behavioral guys, and in Russia. So looking at the study of behavioral responses was super interesting, but then it got taken over at the University of Washington, and Ivar Lovaas did a lot of interesting stuff at UCLA, right? And then it got into autism, and then somehow behaviorism got a stronghold in education. And throughout the country, parents aren't told that they have a choice. So if you're a parent or if you're a teacher and you believe that the behavioral contracts that are being used on a student or your child are increasing tension in their nervous system and causing them stress, causing them physiological distress, which means they're going to be kicking, hitting, spitting, getting red in the face, crying, running away, that means the treatment is making the behavior worse. So I'm just underlining what you said. Unconditional positive regard is not a fluffy concept. It is a very keen neuroscience concept, Eric. That's where we need to go.
Yeah, and I think this concept sometimes that you have to choose between that and accountability. And, right. And you know, I think that was discussed in some in multiple podcasts from you, Matthew, that accountability can still occur in the context of good relationships and unconditional positive regard. And so you don't have to choose.
Absolutely. And you can keep everyone safe, and you have to, of course, you have to have accountability, and you have to have measurement, and you can, it can coexist.
Mm-hmm. I think it has to, right? I think the positive regard in the relationship has to have for consequence to be effective. Like, I mean, all of those measures have to be. And I think that's such a good topic that I even wrote a short article for Edutopia about misconceptions of trauma-informed education. One of them is that there is no consequence. That is not the case. Now, what it may mean, there may not be a punishment, but there are consequences, whether logical sometimes or whether natural sometimes. And I give an example of, if a child is dysregulated and they rip everything off of the wall, first we're going to get them regulated, we're going to kind of have conversations, and then we're going to go put everything back on the wall.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, they're not getting suspended, they're not going home, I'm not going to publicly shame them. It just makes sense. So talk more about that, about what role does a boundary and a consequence play in this work?
Well, I want to share something that you, Matthew, you just said that made me think about this, because we're really rethinking the word consequence when we think about behavior. Because if you really think about what consequences are, they are experiences. And sometimes when you change the word, you change perspective. And so one of the things that we're thinking about, and I think about this with as a parent, you know, as a teacher, you know, instead of saying what consequences does my son need so he will make curfew, you know, I want to ask, what experiences can I provide my son so that he feels, you know, ready to do that? What experiences can I provide for this child so that they will understand the importance of curfew, or that they will understand, you know, what they need to do? So that's, it's really, you know, like I said with Guy Stevens today, you know, it just, we have this perspective that has been around for a long time, and people will accept new medical interventions and new technology, but boy, you tell us to change the way we discipline and we put our foot down, because we are creatures of habit and we carry it into generation after generation after generation. And so I think that that's significant with the science, giving the behavior, you know, what's underneath it.
Well, and I think when you're talking about intergenerational transmission of trauma, right, that comes in the way that we punish and the way we, you know, I mean, those things are passed down, and we're talking generations of stronghold to this archaic mindset of behaviorist thinking.
Yeah. And in the new discipline, you know, when you think about, you know, when we think about trauma responsive, it's not programs that schools are implementing. You know, I mean, I am in so many districts where they're leader in me schools, they're conscious discipline schools, they're, you know, PBI, they embrace the PBIS framework. But, you know, if a trauma responsive school has changed their discipline protocols, and they are really looking at co-regulation. They're looking beneath the behavior at the nervous system and physiological challenges, and they're paying huge attention to adult brain and body state.
Yeah. And I, you know, what you were saying, Lori, too, is, you know, I was just thinking, like, a lot of times in those situations, there's a presumption of skill, right? And it goes back to this can't do versus won't do. And so many times there's the presumption that they can do and they won't, that it's a choice.
Yes.
And I think, in the work around like trauma-informed IEPs, it's very simple based on a lot of these concepts, right? And not thinking about IEPs as compliance-based, but skill-focused. And, you know, I remember seeing this one IEP, and the goal was Maria will decrease protesting to 0 times a day. And I remember thinking like, well, I have 2 daughters and I don't want them to essentially be yes men and yes, constantly take everything. But we need to teach them the skills on how to advocate for themselves and how to communicate effectively, how to disagree effectively, and to know when and in what context to do that. But to simply set a goal of never protest and to assume that they know an alternative and that the skill is there, they just choose not to do it, is such a miss when it comes to our assumptions element.
And I think, we're talking about you all oppressive systems that have been built on this silencing of people, right? And I mean that on marginalized communities. I mean, and I even remember, I'm a white male. I totally know this, right? But even as a kid, I remember being like, man, they won't even like let me say what happened, and they won't even let me, as a community of people and a culture of people, to think that has happened and it continues to happen on a greater scope of a culture is mind-boggling, but it is what it is. And I said what I said, and it's the truth. And those are the conversations we've got to be having right now.
It makes, when you think about the reasons for Black boys to be targeted for suspension, expulsion, and harsh discipline at such outrageously higher rates than other children, it makes sense when you think about the etiology, the cause of these fight or flight behaviors, which are unintentional, which are not made to get out of something or to get negative attention, which are very tired and outdated concepts. They are behaviors that happen under the neuroception of threat, and our children of color and persons of color are under more threat. I mean, if this year didn't show that, then, you know, we can move to a different planet. So this whole idea of the neuroscience of safety, and I'm really, oh my gosh, we could take this in so many directions, but I work with a lot of kids on, you know, as an expert on an IEP, right? When parents who are lucky enough to have me come in and talk. And really, again, really well-intentioned behavioral teams are taught to not have a warmly engaged relationship with the child. They are taught to interface with the behavior and not the child. But a child is not a disembodied head, right? A child is not a rat, and a child is not a dog. And so you can't do that. And so a lot of the high risk kids that I've seen, foster kids, kids on the autism spectrum who have been bounced around from aid to aid or school to school because of challenging behaviors, it's because those persons in charge of helping the child haven't been told that what this child needs most of all is having you look at them with care and concern in your face and to help them feel safe. If we did that one little change, we could save millions of dollars on these expensive, behavioral plans, because we'd get kind grandparently like people in there and not behavioral technicians. It's a whole different shift in our concept of what it means to be human.
Yeah, and you know, one thing you're, you know, Mona, I love how you keep talking about that, the kind of the neuroscience and the of the threat and that neuroception of threat. And I think a challenge that a lot of adults have, and I'm guilty of it myself as a parent, is recognizing that I should not be applying what I view as an appropriate level of threat response, right? That if a student perceives threat, that is what's going to impact their own, you know, internal response. You know, and the example I always give is, you know, when my daughters are really young and things, they would lose their minds over like dropping a sprinkle,
yes,
or like losing a Happy Meal, right? And the, you know, of course, my response as a tired, inexperienced parent is to say, it's not a big deal, right? It's just a sprinkle. But that's my lens, right? I'm able to say that
because I'm
a privileged white middle-aged man, and I can get all the sprinkles I want. And so,
yeah.
I think many times we apply this idea. Well, we never assume or we never make the hypothesis that maybe the student felt threatened, even though I didn't intend threat.
Yes.
And it's really hard for adults to make that shift. I experienced that challenge myself.
That is so true. And again, compassion for ourselves, because how many hundreds of times did I say, like, that's not a big deal, you know?
Yeah.
They're hungry. There are starving children in the world, you know, like, eat that. It's tastes fine to me. It should taste good to you. I mean, come on. We have to give ourselves some grace. But this idea of the subjective nature of the neuroception of safety for each and every child is a hard one to explain sometimes, because I will say, I will have that in an IEP, for example. I'll say, this is what this child needs to have a neuroception of safety, right? And then we will list the characteristics of the interaction with the aide or the teacher. And then sometimes the pushback is, look, this is a very seasoned teacher. This is a safe school. What are you talking about? This is a generically safe school. But threat detection is subjective. It's inside. It's invisible. And so when a child hauls out and hits somebody, it's never out of the blue. It's always out of some subjective trigger. And you mentioned that in the beginning, Eric, of the sensitized stress response, which traumatized children have more sensitized stress responses for those reasons that you mentioned. The brain does workarounds to protect itself. So anyway, I don't know where that went, but.
Well, and you all, we're getting a lot of questions about FBAs and BIP, or FBAs and IEPs, because, you know, I think you all, I don't know if you agree or not, as a previous foster parent and sitting in with a psychologist and them saying, or a psychiatrist and them saying, you know, the child has severe PTSD. However, we have to call it ADHD in order for schools to understand what that means.
Right.
That hit me so hard in the chest that's where we are as education, where we are labeling kids with diagnoses when we know it's complex trauma. We know it's the impact of PTSD. We know it's trauma, right? So
yeah.
I'm gonna pull up a question really quick, and it was how do we do goals, right? If we're talking in this way, when we write goals more for the child, and sometimes we need to write goals for the adults, right? And then the other one was, what kind of appropriate accommodations of IEP goals? Because you all, let's be honest, the kids who we're talking about are not the kids, the perfectionist, that is a response, right? We're not talking about the class clowns. When people think trauma kids, they think of your stereotypical kids. They're not thinking about the kid that's quiet. And these conversations happen in IEP meetings all of the time. So what do you recommend?
Well, I would love to respond just as a former special education teacher too, who was writing those traditional BIP and FBAs. And some of the things that now that we're looking at, and you're exactly right, Matthew, you know, you have this classification of emotionally disturbed or behavior disordered, and then you don't want that. So then you go with other health impaired. Because of the stigma. And so one of the templates that we've created is accommodations for children that are experiencing significant adversity and trauma. And the students are a part of that. They are, you know, we have a specific area, because I could die of old age before an IEP ever gets written and approved. And I mean, it sometimes the process is just painstakingly so long, unless they are in an RTI, you know, process, where then it's shorter. But we are creating an accommodations for trauma, where we are focusing on regulation and sensory embodied regulation and connection. So, and it's not, I mean, we all sit together and the student is a part of that. And the student begins to identify two or three regulatory practices that feel good to them. You know, they know, we forget to ask a child, who in this building do you trust? Who are the two adults that you feel safe with, you know, when you go there? And that is another part of this, is we're creating a medium backup system so that we can be preventative. And so when, before we reach that point of no return, we've taught that ahead of time, that the child knows that they have two or three practices that are built in for them, or they can go to a space in the building that is calming to their nervous system.
Such a novel idea of asking kids. It's right? I mean, but it goes back to what Eric was saying about self-advocating and being able to self-advocate. I mean, you know, it's so interesting that we teach kids not to self-advocate. Right. And then when they become adults, they're like, well, why didn't they say anything? Or why aren't they advocating? Or they don't advocate in the right way, right? It's just so powerful. And Eric, didn't you write it was a book, right? Around IEPs?
Yeah. So it's called Applying a Trauma-Informed Framework to the IEP Process. And I wrote it with Dr. David Bateman, who's a special education professor out of Shippensburg University. And we cover everything from, writing PLAPS and goals, to family engagement, to assessments, to report writing, and how do you set up the meeting room and consider even just where people are sitting. Mm-hmm. And Lori, I know as a special educator and now all the work you're doing, you've done a lot of great things. And I've seen some of the handouts you have, which are excellent and relatable and practical. And I share them regularly. So thank you for those. I think the goals, again, to be short and brief about it, when we're talking about goals, they shouldn't be on compliance. They shouldn't be focused on not doing something. You know, there's the dead man's rule for IEP goals, if you've never heard of it. It's if a dead man can accomplish it. If a dead man can accomplish it, it's not sufficiently ambitious. So if your goal is to sit still, not say anything, it's not a good, sufficient goal. It needs to be measurable. It needs to be reasonable. I think one of the questions I get a lot of times is when we talk about goals that are focused on skill building, they'll say, but it needs to be measurable. I need to have my 4 out of 5 times, right? This will happen. Mm-hmm. And I often say our goals can still be focused on skill building and measured with an outcome, with a metric that's still measurable. But the goal should not be just to stop doing it. The goal should be skill building, and the outcome and the measurable outcome can likely be a reduction in some of the concerning behaviors. The other thing I notice, and I can, you know, unfortunately, I could talk about this all day, so I'll stop after this, is we don't think about the role of the educator sometimes. So as an example is, I've seen a goal that says student will respond calmly when consequences are administered. I remember seeing that and I thought, well, how are the consequences administered? Is it in the heat of the moment and someone's standing over them with their finger in their face and telling them to get out of school? Or is it after they've regulated and they, is it someone that they have a close relationship and they discuss reasonable consequences, and what are the consequences? And, you know, that goal is going to be completely dependent on the educator, not on the student. Yet we are making the student completely accountable for it. So there's a lot of ways to think about how we can do our IEPs a little better with a trauma-informed lens.
Yeah. There's a typical IEP goal that I've seen so many times for my foster kids. And that would be something akin to student will learn to request their something in a polite way, you know, or something like that, right? 4 out of 5 times a student will ask for something rather than XYZ. And so, okay, so that's a goal that is based on, again, based on compliance, based on kind of having the child look acceptable. And the, what we shifted in that goal was that this student will begin to recognize when their state is shifting. We call it physiological state, but this, we have different ways of coding it for the student. But basically, the student, when they start to feel a tiny bit shaky, because when you're traumatized, anything can set you off. A smell, a sound, a movement, a thought, a flashback. And by the way, somebody wrote in here that this should be for all students. Trauma-sensitive goals, yes, they're not just for traumatized students. They're for everybody. Yes. So when if we can help a child compassionately understand, understand and befriend their nervous system, as Deb Dana says, we want to start, as you all said, by befriending our own nervous systems first, because we could be the best teacher in the world. But if we're in a stressed state, the child will pick up on a stressed state first and not what we say. So that's why we are the container. The therapeutic use of self is everything, because emotions are contagious. That is documented. It's not contagious as in a virus, but contagious as in neuroception. And then trying to shift our goals, our IEP goals, to an understanding of behaviors as something bad to behaviors as indicators of an adaptation that their brain is making in terms of movement or non-movement. So if a child is yelling and screaming or yelling profanities or trying to escape or hitting other people, that's the nervous system trying to calm down through movement. If a child is completely shut down and not talking or answering, that's a very serious sign that the nervous system is losing hope. So if we start to use the language of what is that child's nervous system needing, I know it's a foreign idea. It's like not really in IEP goals really yet. But we have to get around 4 out of 5 times the student will do X.
Yes.
And somebody put in as a bit of sarcasm, which goes right along there, that students cross the street safely 4 out of 5 times.
Yes.
And it's that one time that gets them, right? But I wanna say this in that we're talking a lot about what we need to do different. And I wanna validate the educators, right? Because so many, you all, I was not a trauma-informed principal my first year. I think I used a lot of the concepts because I'm a naturally empathetic person. That's just how I'm a product of my mother, where I connected to kids even as a classroom teacher. But there were things I did that was like, oh my goodness. And even as a first year principal, that paradigm shift was, I'm actually hurting kids, like emotionally, not physically, emotionally hurting kids. I had to come to that paradigm. And I think a lot of educators are at that precipice of going, I've got to do something different, right? And I want to validate just how hard being an educator is and how hard it is right now and how hard it was 2 years ago and 10 years ago and 15 years ago, the responsibility and the weight, right? And I think that we've got to understand that this is a not all or nothing. It's a progression. Yes. It's not a end. There is no end goal. There is no, I run across the finish line. I'm the most trauma-informed, trauma-responsive, trauma-aware, trauma person, right? It's a progression of a deeper understanding and doing better. And I think in the words of Bruce Perry on this podcast was, we do better when we know better. And I want people to not self-shame, not feel like, oh my gosh, I'm such a horrible educator. It's just... And when I give keynotes, I say these two things. You can act or accept, right? We can act upon all of this information that we're getting, or we can just say, that's cool.
Right? Yeah, I think about that a lot. And I think about it from an analogy of health, right? That how healthy are you and how healthy are your behaviors? It's okay if you eat a cupcake one time and you gave in, right? That doesn't make you you're not an unhealthy or healthy person, right? You're constantly working to be a little better. And I think the other thing is always use yourself as your baseline, not other people as your baseline. And always work to improve from where you are and where you were. At least that's how I think about it. Maybe that just helps me sleep at night a little bit.
I want to add that this year in August, when many of the schools went back hybrid, I cannot, there are no words to describe what our teachers across this nation have had to contend with this year. Unless you have been in the classroom and you have watched them try to figure out technology of kids that have very little reception, that aren't on the screen, that you have six kids in your room that are needing you, you've got content testing is coming up. We're not waiting testing in our country this year. I came home after the first couple of days, and I was only there two mornings. I have such respect. This has just been a year that for parents, for educators, and for students, there has been no greater challenge. And I want to end tonight by just sharing with our educators that I want you to tap into your strengths, because what you have so beautifully given to our children is we see you, we feel you, and we notice you. And it's been unbelievable. It brings tears to my eyes, what they have and what they are going through right now.
And I'm proud to say I am you, right? I see it. I experience it. We all are, to be honest. The work that we do is hard work, and the hard work we do in the middle of a pandemic is really hard. And I think too, that we have to give ourselves, we have a word in my school that we openly share, and it's pre-forgiveness. We have to pre-forgive ourselves in this space, because at the end of the day, we're all doing the best we can, right? That positive regard goes for adults as well. You all, it's unbelievable that this has been 1 hour, and I wish we had like three more, but I do want to end, as I do every podcast. What is it that you, and we've kind of already touched on it, what do you want educators to know right now?
Oh, I want educators to know that we talked about this. This is your true hero's journey. Thank you so much for what you're doing. This is an impossible task. And now we're also thinking about adding a disruptive paradigm shift on top of it. So if you felt a little unsettled tonight over the conversation about the future for our thinking about behaviors, for now, self-compassion, you are a hero, you're doing the best you can, and thank you for that. We'll get to the other side.
What about you, Eric? What about you, Lori?
Lori, you want to go first?
I mean, sure. I think I just want to end tonight by, really looking at not only the strengths, but I think we have a meaning crisis. I love what Dr. Ian McGill-Chris talks about. And he says that any time, like a pandemic, it's a time for us to come together, to find the common cause, to really support one another. And I'm trying in this time to look at parenting through a different lens of my own children, to look at teaching, to look to see, when we think about being trauma responsive, where we feel stuck maybe in our belief systems, where can we shift and move a little bit? So I really am hopeful for this time. And I want to end tonight by just again saying not even gratitude, it's appreciation with no conditions for everything you're doing. And Matthew, thank you so much for having us tonight and for all you do, you know, with the students that you sit beside. So yeah, thank you.
So I'll just add, you know, for one, I echo everything that Mona and Lori said, not just appreciation, but complete admiration. And, I recently ran into one of my child's teachers out on the street, because my kids are still virtual. And I just told her she did. And this was actually back in the fall. And I just said, you know, I can't imagine how difficult this is. I just want to thank you for everything you're doing. This must be so hard. I can't even imagine. All I can do is just thank you for showing up every day and being so wonderful. And immediately she said, am I doing a good job? Is she doing okay? Is she learning? Is she having fun? Those questions said so much to me, right? She is not only self-conscious, but that's what she cares about. She cares, is she having fun? Does she feel connected? Is she learning? That's what she really wanted to know. And she legitimately was stressed about it. And so it's been I've been writing both teachers regularly. You're doing awesome. I'm amazed by you. And I think that goes for everyone. So really just educators, administrators. I know Matthew, you as a principal, the fact that you are enabling your staff to feel supported, to you're enabling them to turn off at the end of the day. You're telling them to leave the school building at 5 o'clock or don't stay there till 5 o'clock. All those things I am just so appreciative of as a parent.
Well, and very quickly, I know I don't want to take any more of you all's time. It's been over an hour already, but if they want to follow your work, where can they find you on social media? Because we want to make sure they connect. And Eric, I know somebody specifically asked for your book. And if you could tell the title of your book, I will add all of this on the podcast. But for those actually listening right now, I would love for them to be able to keep in contact with all of you.
Sure. I'll start. So I have a website. It's ericrossin.com. You can follow me on Twitter at @E_Rossin. So the book on the IEPs is called Applying a Trauma-Informed Framework to the IEP Process. It's from LRP Publications. And I've also edited a second edition of Supporting and Educating Traumatized Students, Guide for School-Based Professionals. That's from Oxford University Press. Both of those are on the website.
That's great. Lori?
Oh, yeah, there it is.
The book is Beyond Behaviors, available on Amazon and some bookstores and the publisher, Pessy. I've just grown to love social media because it's a way to connect and have a community. Mona Delhook, PhD on Facebook, at Mona Delhook at Instagram and Twitter. And my website has a monadelahook.com, and I have a newsletter that probably goes out twice a year. So it's very short, but I have an upcoming training based on the book that's coming out. So if you want info on that, just sign up for my newsletter on my website.
Your turn, Lori.
And so Mona endorsed that, and so did Matthew. My new book, Connections Over Compliance, Rewiring Our Perceptions of Discipline. And I too, like Mona, I love social media. My girls, they make fun of me all the time, like, Mom. So you can find me on Twitter, Desitel_PhD, and Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn. And my website is revelationsineducation.com. And again, Matthew, thank you so much for this tonight. And Mona, thank you. It was a joy. One of these days we'll get together. Eric, it was so nice to meet you. And yeah, thanks everybody.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Eric, Matthew, thank you so much.
Anytime. Well, thank you all. And for the listeners, do not forget, actually tomorrow is the deadline to get your RFP in for the Trauma Informed Educators Network Conference. This is technically our second year, although it should be our third, but the pandemic threw that out there. It will be July 19th through the 21st. It is going to be virtual. And we have a great lineup. We have two amazing keynote speakers. We have a panel of experts. We have over 40. We will have over 40 sessions to the conference. So take a look at that. Also, if you want to follow me, you can follow me at Principalist on Facebook or on Twitter and Instagram. I'm Matthew Portell on Facebook. And please follow the Trauma Informed Educators Network podcast and the Trauma Informed Educators Network. And as always, please, 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 wash your hands and wear a mask.